God, it's unbelievable that you have orchestrated this universe the way you have. God, that every single one of us, since before creation began, you knew us, you chose us, and you decided to put us in certain places and times. And God, that we are here tonight is no accident. And so, Lord, I pray that not only would you orchestrate us being here, but that you yourself would be here, that you would be present among us, Lord. We invite you, God, to prepare hearts tonight. Lord, I don't know what you'd have me say. So God, I pray that you would say it through me. God, I don't know what your sons and daughters in this audience need to hear. So God, I pray that you'd prepare their hearts and that you would say it to them. And Lord, may a work be done today that cannot be undone. God, meet us here. We beg you, please. We're not asking this of a dead God. We're asking this of a living God. We're praying this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, if you'd have known me a few years ago, I wouldn't have prayed anything like that. My parents are devout Muslims. I was raised in a devout Muslim home. To give you a little bit of an idea of just how devout, my mother was the daughter of a Muslim missionary. So she's like a missionary kid. Even though she's Pakistani by origin, she was born in Indonesia because her father had decided to spend his whole life preaching Islam in Indonesia. And the same, my grandmother, so my maternal grandmother, she was born in Uganda because her father was a Muslim missionary preaching Islam in Uganda. And he was also a physician. And so he would preach and heal in the name of Allah. And so I come from this lineage on my mother's side of Muslim missionaries. And on my father's side, he was very devout as well. He came to the United States in the 70s. Actually, the day my father arrived in the States was the day that Elvis died. And to give you an idea of how familiar he was with the United States, when he landed, he sees a newspaper. It says, "The king is dead." He's like, "I could have sworn they had a democracy." And so he has to start all over learning. But he quickly joined the U.S. Navy. And my father actually spent 24 years of his life serving the U.S. Navy. He retired as a lieutenant commander. And so there are Muslims in the Navy and there are Muslims in the military in general who love and wish to serve this nation. My father loves this nation. He taught me to love this nation. So right off the bat, I hope there's some misconceptions that we can clarify there. But as my father was in the Navy, we had to move around a lot. And so when I was born into this devout home with strong Islamic heritage that moved around a lot. And so my mother had to teach myself and my sister to maintain our identity strongly because she was afraid that the West might influence us. And this is something that's very common amongst immigrants. They don't understand what the West is actually like. They come with preconceptions. They come with ideas that they've been taught about the West. And once they get here, people often don't reach out to them. People don't break those preconceptions. They don't change their minds. They just let them be. And for the rest of their time here in America, they continue on with those preconceptions. So from the Middle East, they're often told that people in the West are promiscuous and that Christianity is, in fact, promiscuous. Because what are they doing? They'll watch the TV. They'll see people on TV. They'll see the soap operas. They'll see the dramas. They'll see people on the beach running around without much clothing on. And for them, that's very immodest. And the whole time, they know that America is a Christian nation. And so they'll take all those things and ascribe that to Christianity. And since they don't know any Christians, generally speaking, no Christians invite them into their homes, those preconceptions continue. And so as I was being raised as a child, I wasn't just taught, Nabil, be a good Muslim. I was taught, Nabil, be ready to respond to Christianity. It was a part of my identity. So what did it look like for me to be a good Muslim growing up? Well, for one, if you're a devout Muslim, you are thinking about Allah all the time. You're thinking about God all the time. For example, first thing in the morning when I would wake up, my mom had taught me to recite a prayer in Arabic, thanking God for waking me up from the death that is sleep. I would recite it in Arabic, Alhamdulillahilladhi ahyana ba'dama amatana wa alayhin nushur, which, unless you speak in tongues, I will translate for you. All praise goes to the one who gives me life and then causes me to die and raises me up again. In other words, when I sleep, it's a type of death, and God wakes me up from that every morning. All praise goes to him, and it's also a foreshadow of the resurrection. Muslims believe in a final day of resurrection, so it's a foreshadow of that. All praise go to the one who gives us life again. First thing in the morning, that's what I was taught to recite in Arabic. And then as I walked to the restroom, I was thinking about certain prayers that my mother had taught me to prepare for the day. And when I walked into the restroom, I would walk in with my left foot first. Why? Because Muslims are taught to emulate Muhammad in everything they do. And Muhammad taught Muslims to step into the bathroom with his left foot first. And so that's what we did. And as we'd walk into the restroom, we'd do ceremonial washings, and we would recite certain prayers while doing the washings. A very, very devoted to tradition life for Muslims. And as soon as I was done with the ceremonial washing, I'd go downstairs to the prayer rugs, where my father had set out in the living room prayer rugs. Every morning, we'd do the first of the five daily prayers. And of course, there's a prayer to pray before the prayer, then you pray the prayer, and you pray the prayer after the prayer. That's just how the Muslim life is. Then I'd go to the breakfast table, and I'd say, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, and I would start my breakfast. And then at the end of the breakfast, I would say another prayer, thanking Allah for making me amongst the believers in Him. And as I would be ushered out of the door by my mother would say, Nabil, don't forget to recite that prayer that Moses used to recite, or that Moses recited before the Pharaoh. When he needed the words to speak, he asked Allah for those words, and he recited this prayer before the Pharaoh. You should recite that every morning before starting school so that God will give you wisdom. And so I had this memorized Arabic prayer that came from the Quran, which starts, Rabbi zidni ilma, O Lord, give me wisdom. And it continues on. This is how the Muslim life works if you're a devout, practicing Muslim. Now, of course, not all Muslims are devout, practicing Muslims, but my family was. And part of the Muslim life, too, that I absolutely loved, and hear me, I loved this. I loved the fact that I was thinking about God all the time, because it definitely scratches that itch to be connected to your Maker. Even if it's, as some of us would say, it's not the real Maker, at least it was satisfying that itch. And in the Muslim life, I remember there were some things that I just looked forward to. Now, we didn't have Christmas as Muslims. We had Ramadan. And the first night of Ramadan was just a magical time, because you weren't quite sure when it would start. The Muslim calendar goes off the moon and not the sun, and so we'd have to wait if there was a new moon that night. And so my father and I would stand outside and we'd look up to see if the moon was a new moon. And if it was, we would pray a certain prayer, and then we'd shout into the kitchen and tell my mom, it's a new moon, and she would recite the prayer, and then she would start preparing the food for the next day, and then we'd have the month of Ramadan, which is a wonderful celebration. I still remember that excitement. I still remember that joy. It brought us together as a family, and Ramadan brought us together as a community. So it was a wonderful time, and living the Muslim life, like I said, was full of joy. But part of being a Muslim in the United States is being ready to respond to Christianity. And so from a very young age, my mother had given me books that not only taught me these Islamic prayers, but they also taught me apologetics, or being able to challenge Christians in their faith. And I'll give you an example of how that looked. When I was at school, this is a story from my junior year of high school. I was in Latin class, and the teacher stepped out for a moment. And the student in front of me was like the token Christian. I went to public school, and so there was like one Christian. And she was very outspoken. And so she turned around and she said to me, Nabil, can I ask you a question? And I was a bit snarky. I was like, you just did, but you can ask another one. She said to me, do you know Jesus? And I'm thinking, okay, this is not a normal place for this conversation, but all right. Yes, Betsy, I do know Jesus. And her eyes just went wide. And I said, Islam teaches me that Jesus is virgin born. Islam teaches me that Jesus is able to cleanse the leprous and heal the blind and even raise the dead. Islam teaches me that Jesus is the Messiah that comes back at the end of times. And she wasn't expecting me to say any of this, but that's what Muslims believe. But then I followed it up with the kicker. But Betsy, I also know Jesus is not God. And she said, no, Nabil, that's the most important part. Jesus is God. And I said, really? Do you believe that? And she said, yes. And I said, is that important to you? And she said, absolutely. And I said, okay, fine. I will grant you the four Gospels. I don't believe the Gospels have been unchanged. I believe that they've been corrupted over time. They don't still contain Jesus' words. But for the sake of this conversation, I'm going to grant you that the Gospels still contain Jesus' words. Where does Jesus say, I am God? She thought for a minute. She didn't get to phone a friend. Just tossing that out there. That didn't get to happen. So she thought for a moment. She thought for a moment, and she says, well, what about in the Gospel of John, where Jesus says, the Father and I are one? Now, I was expecting her to say that, and I said, Betsy, that's not Jesus saying he's God. Of course it's not, because what else does Jesus say in the Gospel of John? Jesus says that he prays for his disciples to be one, just as he is one with the Father. So he's clarifying his unity with the Father. It's something that the disciples can have. So if he were saying he's one being with the Father, he can't pray that for the disciples. They can't all become one being. He's praying for them to be unified in spirit, just as he is unified in spirit with the Father. And if you want any more clarification on that, why not turn to the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus is walking through the crowds and a woman touches him, and Jesus has no idea who touched him. You're telling me God has no idea who touches him? Or how about, again, when he's going through Galilee, and it says he could do no miracles in Galilee. That's what the Bible says. Not he chose not to do miracles. It says he could do no miracles in Galilee. You tell me God can't do miracles? Or how about for further clarification, Mark chapter 13, where Jesus is talking about the end times, and he says he doesn't know when the end of times is. He says no one knows when the end of times is, not the angels nor the Son, but only the Father. So he's saying God knows when the end of times is, but he doesn't. How could he be claiming to be God? And if you really want to go to the Gospel of John, why not go to the verse where Jesus says, the Father is greater than I? How could he possibly be God if he says the Father is greater than I? You know, Betsy hadn't heard any of this before. She wasn't ready for this kind of an attack on her faith. And I saw the confusion in her eyes, and I followed it up by saying, Betsy, if you want to know the real Jesus, ask me about Islam, and I will share Jesus with you. And so I took the one Christian in our class who was on fire enough to share the gospel with me and turned her attempt into my own da'wah, into my own invitation for her to come to Islam. Now, don't get me wrong. I had tremendous respect for Betsy. She was the only person in my class who ever tried to share the gospel with me. And I believed this. Whenever I saw a Christian or someone who called themselves a Christian who didn't share the gospel with me, I thought one of two things is true. Either they don't believe the gospel, or they don't care if I go to hell. What other option is there? Either they don't believe it, or they don't care if I go to hell. So I had tremendous respect for Betsy, even though I felt she was not able to stand up to a simple line of questioning. And these weren't trick questions. I wasn't asking her random stuff about who knows what in the doctrine. I was asking her about central matters of theology. How do you know Jesus is God? And she wasn't alone. Every time I asked these questions to Christians, generally speaking, they had no idea what to say. And it was because of their lack of preparedness that I was able to turn many Christians away from a walk of faith into a walk of doubt. This continued. This continued. And by the way, every time I had such a conversation, it bolstered me in my Islamic belief. My parents had taught me why Christians couldn't answer these questions. It was because there was no answer to these questions. Jesus didn't claim to be God. In fact, what is the Trinity even? It makes no sense. Muslims are taught by their imams, by their parents, that the Trinity is polytheism. You want to believe in one God, but you want to believe in multiple gods at the same time. So you say it's one, three in one. And when you ask to explain the contradiction, oh, it's a mystery. We can't explain it. Now, the only mystery here is how you could believe such a thing. To me, that was a shock, that so many people would take such central doctrines and not be able to even explain them, let alone defend them. Until I got to college. When I got to the university level, I joined the debate and forensics team. And on the team, we were going for a tournament, and one of the first tournaments we went to was in up in the Northeast. And one of the guys in the team that I ended up spending the night with in the hotel room, as he was unpacking his clothes, I saw that he had a Bible. And I was like, are you a Christian? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, all right, let's go. This will be fun. And I said, do you realize that your book you're reading is not trustworthy? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, Jesus spoke in Aramaic. And the earliest church was in Jerusalem, so they probably spoke Hebrew. And then the New Testament's written in Greek. So by the time you actually have the New Testament written, you have a translation of a translation of Jesus' words. How can you trust a translation of a translation? Don't things get lost in translation? And then not only that, but the New Testament that was written in Greek wasn't the one that the church really used for the span of time. That was the Latin translation, the Vulgate. And it goes from Latin to German before it comes to English. And so ultimately, you have a translation of 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 Jesus' words, which is why you have the NIV, the NRSV, the ESV, the NASV, the who knows what V. You got so many versions of the Bible. How can I know which one is actually Jesus' words? Now, I had used this argument with Christians many times before. But what I didn't know about David was that he had spent the previous 5 years studying the Bible and apologetics. And so the whole time, the whole afternoon, he had seen that there was a Muslim on the team, and he's been praying, God, open the door for me to share the gospel. Open the door for me to share the gospel. And I was just like, hey, right out through that door. So David says to me, Nabil, just a few moments ago, I heard you speaking to your mother on the phone. Was that in English? I said, no. And he said, but when you told me what she said, you told me in English. Was that a bad translation? No. He says, Nabil, when people are multilingual, they can accurately take something they hear in one language and translate the message into another language. That's what they do. And that's exactly what the disciples did. They took what Jesus said in Aramaic, and they were able to translate that into Greek just fine. And we have in our possession today over 5,700 Greek New Testament manuscripts from which we can reconstruct the entire New Testament many times over. And he said, Nabil, even if we didn't have a single one of those New Testament manuscripts, we have in our possession over 10,000 Latin, Coptic, and Syriac translations of the New Testament from ancient times, from which we could reconstruct the entire New Testament many times over again. Some of them are whole Bibles from the early 300s. And if we didn't have any of those, we have early church fathers quoting the New Testament tens of thousands of times, and we can reconstruct the entire New Testament virtually from those quotations once again. Nabil, we can be sure of what the New Testament says. I looked at him and I said, David, you're making this up. I was like, I've talked to tons of Christians. None of them have said this before. He said, you think I'm making this up? I said, I think you're making this up. He said, you better bring it. I said, it's been brought. Let's go. And so David and I became best friends. At that point, we realized I was a pre-med student. He was in biology and philosophy. So we started signing up for classes together just so we could continue arguing with each other. I mean, we would talk about Jesus all the time, and we were signed up for genetics, chemistry, biology, vertebrate zoology. That was fun. Our teacher was an atheist, so Muslim and Christian talking about the atheist. Anyway, I'll spare you the stories. But we had a blast. Ultimately, during this time, he and I became best friends because we both cared about God. You know, he had a different view of God than I did, but he wasn't trying to tear me down, and I knew that because he was my friend. When he would share Christianity with me, even if it challenged everything I believed to my very core, I knew he was doing that because he was my friend and not because he was attacking me. And the same with him. When I would share Islam with him, he would hear it because he knew I was trying to help him and not try to tear him down. And here's the point I'm trying to make. When you share the gospel with someone, it is a heavy burden. Don't forget that Christ says the gospel, if you're going to follow it and if you're going to be worthy of following Christ, you have to pick up your cross and follow him. The gospel is a call to die. And when someone hears it, if they don't know they can trust you, if they don't know who you are and that you care, then they're not going to listen to you. Relationships are a requisite bridge for sharing the gospel. So David and I became best of friends during this time. And in this course of time, we studied the New Testament, and it took me a year to study the New Testament to the point where I came to the conclusion, it's accurate. I looked at the history of the New Testament and I realized there is no possible method for the New Testament, because of the way it was copied and spread and passed on in early times, there's no possible way for the message to have been uniformly and undetectably altered. There's no way. How could it have been done? There's no model. And when I realized the New Testament couldn't have been altered, I said, okay, fine, but where does Jesus claim to be God? And I'll tell you, I don't have enough time to go into the details here, but this is what mattered to me the most. Because the Quran says very clearly in Surah Al-Maidah, verse 72, that Jesus is not God. In fact, those who think Jesus is God they are going to go to hell. That's what chapter 5, verse 72 of the Quran says. And so I knew there was no possible way Jesus could have claimed to be God. Nor could Jesus have died on the cross, because Surah An-Nisa, chapter 4 of the Quran, verse 157, says, he was not killed, nor was he crucified, but so it was made to appear. So, Muslims believe Jesus did not die on the cross. If he did not die on the cross, he could not have risen from the dead. And he did not claim to be God. Those are three things that Muslims deny about Jesus. Oh, they believe he's the Messiah. They believe he could do miracles. They believe he could even raise the dead and that he's going to come back at the end of times. You can believe all that. But you can't believe three things about Jesus in Islam, that he died on the cross, that he rose from the dead, and that he claimed to be God. Well, guess what Christianity says? If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Those very three things that Islam denies, Christianity teaches that it's those three things you have to believe in order to be saved. So Islam and Christianity can't both be true. In fact, on the fundamentals, they are totally contradictory. So what I decided to do at this point was to study exactly those three points. Can we know historically whether or not Jesus claimed to be God? Can we know, using a historian's lenses, whether he died on the cross and whether he rose from the dead? And so at this point, even though I was a pre-medical student, I decided to start learning historiography. I started to learn the historical method in order to ascertain just how trustworthy the historical sources are and what they say about Jesus. And I'll spare you the details once again. There was a whole conference here this weekend on these topics. I'll spare you the details, but here's what I concluded. There is no way we can historically deny Jesus' crucifixion on the cross. It's incontrovertible. If you're going to believe anything about history, you have to believe Jesus died on the cross. And what about his resurrection from the dead? Can that be historically shown? Once again, I concluded that the resurrection of Jesus is the best explanation of the events surrounding Jesus' death on the cross. If you're going to stand back from the historical events on Jesus' life and say, look, I don't know what happened, then you can get away without concluding the resurrection. But if you're going to provide any kind of explanation on what happened to Jesus after he died, the best conclusion by far is that Jesus rose from the dead. And I concluded this as a Muslim. And then when it came to the issue of the deity of Christ, I looked at the historical records once again. I found a lot in the Gospel of John which showed Jesus claiming to be God. He called himself the I Am many times in the Gospel of John. But then I realized, wait a minute, John's Gospel is the last of the four Gospels. Why does it take until John's Gospel for Jesus to say he's God? What about the first three? And so I said, I want to see it in the first Gospel. I want to see it in Mark's Gospel if Jesus claims to be God. So I started studying Mark's Gospel. Now, at this point, by the way, it's taken years to get to this point. But what I realized, after I study the context of Mark's Gospel, I'll send you home with some homework if you're interested, but the entire gospel builds up to one point, to one climax. Throughout it, people keep asking Jesus, who are you? Who are you? And he doesn't tell people who he is. He says, don't tell anyone. And those people who have some idea of who he is, he says, don't tell anyone. There's only one place in the entire gospel where Jesus publicly proclaims his identity. And it's Mark chapter 14, verse 62. And if you read it in its historical context, Jesus makes at least two, maybe three undeniable claims to being God. In Mark 14, 62, he refers, basically, after you've unpacked the whole thing, he says, I am the God of Daniel, and I am the God of David. And that's why, at the end of the trial scene, the high priest rips open his robes and says, what further need do we have to question the man? You've heard the blasphemy. What shall we do? And they said, crucify him. He claimed to be God in front of all of them. And so I'm reading this. As a Muslim, I'm seeing this with my own eyes, and I realize not only does this establish a strong case for Christianity, but it challenges Islam. Now, by the way, some of you out there might be skeptical at this point and say, how does that establish a strong case for Christianity? Let me break it down for you. I graduated from medical school in 2009. Part of what I studied a lot of in my fourth year of medical school was psychiatry. I was very interested in the way the mind works. Well, part of what happened when you work in the psychiatry ward is people would come in and claim to be God. That's not abnormal. And the general response was, oh, great, we have a room for you. It's padded. It's really nice padding. You just come on in. You know, that's how you naturally respond to someone who claims to be God. So if Jesus claimed to be God, the natural reaction should be, so what? But he followed it up. He said he would die and then raise from the dead. Now, if someone walks up to me and says, Nabil, I am God, my first response would be, no, you're crazy. And then they would say, no, watch. They're going to kill me for this claim, and then I'm going to raise myself from the dead. I will be raised from the dead in 3 days. If that man rises from the dead, now I have something to wrestle with. Now I have to conclude there's something going on with this man. And frankly, if there's anyone I'm going to believe about the afterlife, it's going to be the one who's been there. And so if we can show beyond historical doubt or beyond reasonable historical doubt that Jesus claimed to be God, died on the cross, and then rose from the dead, we have an excellent case for Christianity. Then I turned my eyes to Islam, and I said, okay, what's the case for Islam at this point? Actually, that was David's doing. He's like, Nabil, you've been very one-sided in this investigation. Why don't you start looking at Islam? And I still had a lot of confidence. Islam's true. Of course Islam's true. But when I looked at Islam, and I'm going to save you the details, but when I looked at Islam, not only did I lose all confidence in the historical nature of Islam, I was horrified by what I learned. A lot of the sources I simply had not read. A lot of the history hadn't been given to me. And when I started studying it and investigating it, I realized all the reasons I had for believing Islam was true was false. And then there was much worse to be found as well. And so this brought me to a crisis point. At this point, I realized that it's quite possible I've been following a falsehood all my life. But you don't just change your beliefs. It's near impossible to just change without first realizing the cost. In my case, my mother and father, who had given absolutely everything to me, I mean, they came from another country with nothing. When my father joined the Navy, he had nothing. He and my mother, they used to wash out fast food dishes in order to have something to take home. Back then, you had little styrofoam boxes from McDonald's you'd get. They used to wash those out, and they used to keep those as their dishes. That's how little they had. Yet they came here to give my sister and me an opportunity to succeed. And if I became a believer, if I became a Christian, well, I was going to not only take everything they had given me and thrown it back in their faces, I was going to take the very themselves, because don't forget, generally speaking, Muslims come from honor-shame cultures. They've built up honor in their lives at this point in their life, in their society, in their community. It's honor that has built them up to this place now. And if I become a Christian, I'm going to take the biggest shame they could possibly have and thrust it upon them. And they're going to lose not just me, and not just our relationship, but everything they've built for themselves. And I'm not thinking about this consciously. I'm thinking about this subconsciously. It's weighing on me as I try to make these decisions. And so I go to God and I say, God, can you show me who you are? Can you show me who you are? Because there's too much at stake here. There's too much at stake for me to just make a decision. And so what Muslims often do when they ask God for something is they ask for dreams and visions. My mother, my father, they had shown me throughout their lives. Whenever they wanted to ask God for guidance, they asked for dreams. There's actually a type of prayer called Salat Istikhara, which we would actually pray and ask God for guidance. My sister decided who to marry, who not to marry, based on dreams. My father decided what job to take, what not to take. Frankly, they often had prophetic dreams. My mother, when she got married, shortly thereafter, she had a dream where she planted 4 seeds into the ground, and 2 of those seeds sprouted into trees, and 2 did not. And so she woke up from this dream. She told it to my aunt, her sister-in-law. And my aunt said, blessed are you, for you know already what's going to come of your pregnancies. You will have 2 children, and you will have 2 miscarriages. Fast forward 20 years, that's exactly what happened to my mother. This is normal. My grandmother had prophetic dreams. And I'm not here to explain them to you. I'm just telling you they happen. Some of them are really creepy. I could share some creepy dreams with you, but I'm gonna leave that out for now. So when it came time for me to ask God, who are you? The first thing I asked for was for a vision or a dream. And I got to this point where I was asking him, and by the way, I was going from mosque to mosque to mosque in this time, asking imams to resolve some of the contradictions and some of the problems I found in the Quran and in Islamic history. And as I'm going to these mosques, I'm pouring myself out saying, God, can you show me who you are? In my daily prayers, God, please. And it was December of 2004, after my first year of medical school. So by the way, I've already gone through all of undergraduate schooling, and I'm in medical school at this point. It's the end of the first semester, December of 2004. My father says, Nabil, you've studied really hard. How about you come with me to this conference I'm going to, and we can go, you know, go to the beach. And so I said, sure. And so I'm there in Orlando, Florida. It's midnight. My father's sleeping in the other bed, and I'm at the edge of my bed praying to God in probably the most humble moment of my life. God, show me who you are. And at that moment, the room went pitch black. It was already dark. It was nighttime, but it went pitch black. And where there had been a wall in front of me, it was gone. And all I saw instead were thousands of crosses. And I didn't know if I was having a vision that was lasting a second, a minute. I didn't know, but I felt God was telling me something. And just as soon as the crosses came, they were gone. And I looked up at God and I said, God, that doesn't count. I was like, I'm jet lagged, I'm tired. I can't hinge my eternal destiny on this. I mean, I'm going to Epcot Center, you know, it's a small world after all, it's all in my head. I can't hinge my eternal destiny on this. Well, God wouldn't let me go too far. He gave me three dreams. And the second dream was a very clear one, and I'll tell you what it was. In the second dream, I'm at the threshold of a narrow door. Okay, this door is just wide enough to fit me. I mean, that's one of the most poignant parts of the dream, is just how narrow this door was. And it's just tall enough to fit me. And it's got some depth to it, maybe 5 feet, and then it's made of brick, and there's this room on the other side of this doorway, and it's got a feast going on inside. Round tables set with a feast, and there's people sitting down at the tables, but no one started eating yet. It's like they've just sat down and nothing started yet. And they're all waiting for an owner or a speaker or somebody to start this event. Now, I knew in the dream that that was the kingdom of heaven. I knew it. And I knew I had to get through this doorway in order to get there. But I couldn't, because right at the other end of the doorway was my friend David. He was sitting down as well, just like everyone else. He's kind of blocking it. It's a very David thing to do, just sitting there. And I looked at him. I said, David, I thought we were going to eat together. And he said, you haven't responded. And I knew right there in the dream that I needed to respond to David's invitation in order to get into heaven. But this is where it gets crazy. I wake up and I call David and I said, David, I just had this dream. What do you think it means? And it was probably the first time I ever heard anyone roll their eyes over the phone. He's like, Nabil, this dream is so clear. I don't have to tell you what it means. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, go to Luke chapter 13, verse 22. And David knew his Bible, and he had given me a Bible well before I planned on reading it. And so I open up the Bible, Luke chapter 13, verse 22. And in the Bible he gave me, it was a Zondervan NIV study Bible. It said there, the narrow door, in big bold letters. And my heart stopped because I hadn't read this before. And I'm going to paraphrase it for you. Basically, it says, Jesus was going through the towns and villages preaching the good news, and the disciples asked him, Lord, are many going to be saved? And he said, make every effort to enter through that narrow door, because many, I tell you, will try, and few will be able. And you will see people sitting inside at the feast of the kingdom of heaven. Make every effort to enter before the owner comes and closes that door, or you'll be left outside weeping and gnashing your teeth. God gave me a dream where he showed me exactly where I stood based on a biblical parable I hadn't read that had been recorded in the Bible 2,000 years before. And so I knew what I had to do at that point. I asked God for a third dream. Don't judge, Christians. And so after the third dream, I mean, it was abundantly clear what I had to do. The problem was what I would have to give up. And so I was driving to, this is now the second year of med school. It was the first day of second year of med school. I'm driving to class and I'm just crying. This is down in Virginia. This is on 264 heading into Norfolk. I was just crying because I knew what I was about to give up. And I said, God, I know what I have to do now, but I need time to mourn. I need time to mourn. And as I was approaching the school, I said, I can't do this. I need to go back to my apartment. And so I went back to my apartment and I said, I need to seek God's comfort. And I didn't know where to find it. So I pulled out a Bible and a Quran. I just sat there with both of them. And I opened up the Quran first and I started looking through it for comfort. And as I'm reading through the Quran for the first time for actual comfort, I realized there is none. There's nothing in the Quran designed to comfort a hurting human. Nothing. There's nothing that speaks to the human plight whatsoever. It's a book of laws and commands and rules that belongs in the 7th century. And I realized this, and I put it aside. And I said, fine, I don't know where to turn in the Bible. I'll just start with the New Testament. So I opened up the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1. Saw a bunch of genealogies. Skipped them. It's coded in. Skip them. It didn't take me long to get to Matthew chapter 5. And I was reading through it. It said, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And when I saw those words, it was like they were glowing. It was like it was electric, and it just jumped off the page into my heart. And for the first time, I felt I was actually holding the word of God. And I cannot put this down. And I started reading it, and every single question I would ask would be answered in the footnotes. I'd say, God, how do I know you're hearing me? And the footnotes would say, if you want to know, God is hearing you. Go to 1 John 5. Yes. Boom. And so I'm following all these cross references. It takes me forever because I'm reading every single one to get from Matthew chapter 5 to Matthew chapter 10. About a week. And when I get to Matthew chapter 10, it says, he who confesses me before the people of this world, I will confess before my Father in heaven. He who denies me before the people of this world, I will deny before my Father in heaven. It was clear as day at this point. Part of being a believer is being able to confess your Lord before others. And I hadn't done that. I knew who Jesus was. I had all the evidence. I had all the spiritual guidance. Now I had emotional fulfillment from the Bible, but I still hadn't proclaimed him. And so I got on my knees, and I prayed a prayer. No one had ever told me about the sinner's prayer. I just made one up. It sounded very Muslim. But I was like, God, I submit to you. I submit that you are Jesus, and you died on the cross for my sins, and you rose from the dead. You are my Lord. Take my life into your hands. And it was at that moment that I assented to the gospel. But I didn't really understand what it was until a few days later, when the night before, I had seen my father cry the only tears I'd ever seen him cry in my life. I don't think I can explain to you just what my father was to me. He was my Superman. I mean, he was my archetype of strength. Growing up, he would go out to sea regularly to fight for our country. He was strength to me. And he said these words to me. He said, Nabil, today I feel as if my backbone has been ripped out from inside me. I'd never seen him cry before. And my mother, who's never short of words, didn't say a thing. Just this look in her eyes like, my son, how could you have betrayed me like this? And she just walked out. And I found out shortly after that my father took her to the hospital because she was having heart pain, which was my primary concern in telling them. And so the next morning, I am sitting on my knees, praying to God, with an anguish I have never felt before, with a pain I had never felt before, praying, God, why did you leave me here? After I became a believer, I believed. Why didn't you take me up to you? I didn't need to be here anymore. My family would have been happier. At least I wouldn't have betrayed them. I would have been gone, but I wouldn't have betrayed them. I'm pleading with God, God, why did you not kill me? And as I'm saying that over and over, sometimes when you're, you know, emotionally upset, you just, why didn't you kill me? Why didn't you just start saying things over and over? That's what I was doing. Why didn't you kill me? Why didn't you kill me? I'm not here to mess with your theology. I'm just here to tell you what happened. It was as if someone picked up a megaphone and spoke right into my soul. Because Nabil, this is not about you. And right then, all the tears stopped. All the tears stopped. It was like I was frozen. And literally, I was frozen. I couldn't move for 10 minutes. I was rooted to the ground, unable to move. I think I was being rebooted. Then I get up and I walk out. And everything looks different. For the first time in my life, it's as if the trees were brighter, the sky was bluer, sounds were crisper, everything was different. And I look and I see someone crossing the street. And I've seen that before so many times, someone crossing the street. But for the first time, what hit me was that person needs to know about God. What hit me was that person probably believes the same lies that everyone else believes, that life is about working, making money, so you can pay the bills, so you can work some more, make some more money, and go until you die. And that's what life is about. He probably believes that lie, and in the middle of that, he has depression, he feels no meaning, he feels no purpose. In medical school, and he was walking in that direction to the medical school, in medical school, we're taught that life came about by accident, by electricity through the atmosphere. Life just happened to come about, and evolution happened, and here we are. Well, what does that say about us? It means that we are an accident, and life has no purpose or value. And these are the lies that people are believing, even this person walking across the street. And I now have a truth. I now am able to tell that person, no, you are not an accident. God thought about you. God loved you. God orchestrated this world before its creation to bring you about so that you could have a loving relationship with him. All of those things you do, all your quirks, all your tendencies, God loves you just like that. And in fact, he wants to use those through you to change the world. God has designed you to be a world changer. If he can change this world through 12 disciples, one of whom betrayed him, he can change this world through you. And that's what I felt I had to tell this person. I mean, God died on the cross. Muslims believe that God is the most amazing being ever. They do, but they can never conceptualize that God would enter into this world. How could God enter in this world? This world is filthy. Why would God lower himself? That would mean he'd have to leave his majesty up there. Yes, it does. God left his majesty, came here, was raised as a child, born to two other children. His parents were accused of an illegitimate relationship. He was accused of being an illegitimate child his whole life. He bore that ignominy for what purpose? Incidentally? On accident? No, so he can tell other people who bear the same shame, I understand, and I love you just as you are. And he picks 12 disciples who are not learned, who are not courageous, and he works with them until they all run away from him. So that he can tell you, have you been betrayed by someone who loves you? Has someone who promised to stand up with you even to death, have they left you? If they have, I understand. And I love you all the same. And then he's taken and put on a cross. Oh, not before he's flogged. And if you don't know what the flogging process is, it was designed to rip your skin off your body. Cicero tells us that people's arteries and veins were laid bare. During the crucifixion process, people's intestines fell out because this whip was designed to rip your flesh off your body. Jesus was scourged with that whip, then he's put on a cross. And as he's hanging on the cross, every time he wants to breathe, he has to push up off a nail through his feet. No skin on his back, against splintered wood, every time he wants to breathe. Why is he doing this? Why is God willing to suffer this much? What we should remember are the words he tells us. As he's doing this, it is out of love for us. And he tells us, as I have loved you, so love one another. Here is the gospel. God, who had everything, was willing to pour himself out to absolutely nothing for the sake of those who were his enemies. And we have to do the same. How are we going to call ourselves followers of Jesus unless we follow Jesus? And once I realized that, once I saw that person crossing the street, once I realized what the gospel actually meant, I realized there was no turning back. There was no way I could live this life without proclaiming what he has done. In fact, I wanted to die. I asked for death. And for me at that point, that was death. This new life is far greater. You can bring hope to people just by introducing them to their father. Oh, the Quran says to Muslims over and over again, God is not your father. God has no son. God has no children. He doesn't beget. There are billions of people walking around this world who believe that God is not their father. Many of them don't have any father. You have the privilege of introducing people to their Heavenly Father who is perfect and who loves them no matter what sins they commit. Let us not drop this opportunity. You know, for those of you who are believers, I challenge you. For the rest of eternity, you're going to look back at your time here on earth and realize it went by like the blink of an eye. But that blink, this short time, is the only time you have to share the gospel, to fight evil, to accomplish something that will reverberate for eternity. This is the only time you have to do that. Avail yourself of this time. And for those of you who don't know Christ, for those of you who haven't quite accepted this whole Christian thing yet, let me tell you, if it costs you everything, if it costs you absolutely everything to follow him, it is worth it. This is where life is. This is where meaning is. This is where hope is. And you can stare death in the face and smile, because it's only going to take you to your maker, and you can know that with certainty. And you can pour your life out for others, knowing that you have a greater reward. Or not just hoping, not just believing, knowing. That's what it means to be a follower of Christ. Christ is absolutely amazing. And to follow him is the greatest privilege.